Right.
There are two types of Maxwell's equations, one applying to closed surfaces, like spheres and bubbles, and there are those that are applied to closed loops, okay? Like loops of Wielocki, loops, curves in free space. And there were two area laws. One of them was Gauss's law for the magnetic field, which I somehow magically start on now instead of the one for the electric field. But the one for the magnetic field is easy. It says if you have any closed surface that encloses an area of space, then the integral of B dot dA over that surface is always zero. So so the idea is that you have a sphere, the dA, the differential area element, is normal to that surface, to that sphere, and the magnetic field might be just passing through it like this. The magnetic field lines flow in sourceless currents, if you like, and the integral of D, all this is saying is that the total integral of the magnetic field over the surface is zero. So if what goes in must come out is one way of summarising this this particular one of Maxwell's equations. The magnetic field is divergence free is another way of saying it. It doesn't diverge from anywhere, or nor does it converge, it simply flows. Okay? And the other simple law that you learnt about magnetic fields is Ampere's circuital law, which in the case where there are no time-varying quantities, or you can neglect very slowly varying time-varying quantities, we have the closed integral of B dot dl around the loop gives you the current that links or threads that loop. So, this is the easy way to remember this one, is if you have a magnetic field that travels around in a circle, which we're describing now what magnetic field lines do when they flow around in circles, then the line integral of V dot dl around an arbitrary curve enclosing a current carrying wire, where this wire has a current I, is given by this. And so, this is a much more useful law than this one, because to say that something total integral equals zero doesn't tell you very much about it. But a simple example of the Ampere circuital law is the case of an infinitely long current-carrying wire that has just one current I. To obtain the magnetic field around it, you then integrate you can tell, first of all, the direction of the magnetic field is given by the right-hand rule. So it looks like that. This radius vector here is, say, R. Then the magnetic field by symmetry is azimuthal, so the integral of B theta times dl is equal to mu naught I. And if we integrate around a circular curve, such as this and the magnetic field is constant on that, then we end up with B theta times 2 pi r equals mu naught I. And we have the simple result that the magnetic field is given by mu naught I over 2 pi r. Okay, just for a single wire. Now, if there are other wires... Now, this law is actually more useful than you think, because you give me any wire, then the closer you get to that wire, the more it looks like it's infinitely long. Simple perspective, as imagine shrinking yourself. And we're also talking here about a wire that's obviously filamentary, obviously not a current that's uniformly distributed throughout space, but a wire... Simple wire. So the requirement is that the radius of the wire, say A, whatever that radius is, be much less than the radius of curvature rho of the wire. Providing that's the case, then you can always find a place close enough to the wire where this law applies, and so the magnetic field is also always pointing in rings around the wire. So if you look at the current coming, say, out of the board along a wire, then the magnetic field lines all look like this, and they drop in with with radius in the magnitude of the magnetic field. This is in Tesla. If the current is in amperes and mu naught is in is 4 pi by 10 to the minus 7 weavers per meter, and R is in meters, then the magnetic field is in Tesla. And so that's one thing about it. The other thing about it is if we have another wire over here, which is parallel to this wire and everywhere and infinitely long, then the total magnetic field in space is given by applying Ampere's law individually to both of these, and then you add them up. But you have to be careful that the magnetic field is a vectorial quantity, so you have to take into account the angle of the magnetic field in each case with respect to these sources. In other words, you can apply superposition. You can get rid of this one and calculate that magnetic field. If this current here is going into the board, then the magnetic field lines due to this current alone are now rotating in the opposite sense in the plane of the board. And you calculate each of them individually. They're given by the same formula, where in the case of this wire, R refers to the distance to the centre of the wire out to the point in the field. For this wire, the R refers to the distance here out to the point in the field. And then you just do a vectorial addition of the magnetic field, taking into account their components. So in reality, there are ways of solving Ampere's circuital law to calculate the magnetic field distribution of any, or the magnetic field of any distribution of currents, for example, solenoids. So it's not surprising that it's a pretty useful law. All right, then I spoke a little bit about, mostly it's of interest to wave motion, but in the circumstance where there is a changing field with time, then the electric field, there's also an electric field component that we needed here in order to satisfy charge conservation. Okay, in many cases, this is just a detail which arises from particularly when we study wave motion. And there is no current anywhere in space. So what happens to a poor old magnetic field if there is no current and the magnetic field moves a long way from the current? Then there the magnetic field gets produced by an electric field. And this electric field term here is referred to as displacement current. All right, then the other law, the other famous circuital law, we've had the law for the magnetic field. The other one is Faraday's law, which describes what happens. In fact, it's actually the analogy of Ampere's law, but now for the magnetic field. For the electric field. So now you have a closed circuit again, okay, with an and we're integrating the electric field around this closed circuit. And Faraday's law says that the electric field is given by the integral of the magnetic time rate of change of the magnetic flux. And this is sometimes called Lenz's law. Okay. So a changing magnetic field causes an electromotive force in an arbitrary circuit around the changing magnetic field. All right, and then just before I summarise these, I'll go back and get the top one now. We've already seen the simple law for the divergence-free magnetic field. Magnetic fields have no sources. They neither diverge nor converge on any point. On the other hand, that's not true for electric field. Right. And it's not obvious. Yes.
Why is there a negative sign in Faraday's law?
Why is there? Or is there?
Why? Why is a negative sign in
To give the right direction of electric field? I don't know. That's actually correct, first of all.
Yeah.
But why is there a negative force, a negative sign? First of all, one way to think about it, this is true as well, is if this is a conducting wire, then the current driven in that wire by this electric field produces a current now which opposes the magnetic field causing that electric field. That's what Lenz's law is all about, and it's brought about by that minus sign. Yeah, but I don't think that may cut the mustard with you as an explanation, does it? Or it's there. All you have to think about for Faraday's law is that whenever you have a changing magnetic field that leaks an area of space, magnetic fields never diverge, right? So they always go around in circles. But if you've got a bunch of magnetic field lines linking a loop of wire, then that loop is alive. Be careful touching it. It's got an electric field, it's got an electromotive force. That's precisely how the 240 volts in the power point is generated, by such a change in magnetic field back at the power station, or at the transformer at the nearest substation, as we'll see in a minute. Okay? Is that all right? Yes. All right, so the first law that I should have spoken about was Gauss's law for the electric field. And the electric fields can diverge and converge. They converge on negative charges. And so if you have a negative charge, electric fields terminate on it. They converge on it. Magnetic fields can't do this, okay? And so Gauss's law simply says that if we integrate the electric flux over the over a closed surface, it's a direct measure of the charge enclosed by that surface. And that's a useful law. Supposing you've got a power line or a transmission line, we've seen this before, with that above Earth, okay, and there's a voltage on this transmission line which propagates along the wire, then there are electric field lines that they might vary with time along this if there are wavelength effects, like this is about lambda over 2, for example. But there are positive charges here and negative charges here, negative charges there and positive charges there. And if we consider our closed surface to be a little pipe that encloses the hypothetical virtual pipe that encloses the transmission line, then we can compute the charge per unit length on this line from the electric field, because the electric field is radial, and so the integral of the electric field over the surface, where the surface now excludes the end bits, normally it would include them, but the electric field is not normal to these end bits. It's only if we have a uniform charged wire, for example, suppose the wire were infinitely long and we charged it to a DC voltage, let's say 12 volts, with respect to, we could say with respect to infinity, and then keep the symmetry, then the electric field line, if it's positive, a positive voltage, we have positive charges on this this wire, and the electric field lines point away from the charges. And they do so, obviously, with cylindrical symmetry. In fact, this entire wire, if we look along it, it looks like this. It's got positive charge, so the electric field points away. But otherwise, this wire I've drawn here, looking along the wire, looks as follows, with the electric field lines pointing away from the wire. Okay. Now, Gauss's law makes it very easy to calculate what the electric field line is. Consider a finite length. It's an infinitely long wire, so let's consider a finite length of wire. The charge, Q, is going to be given by the charge per unit length. Call that chi, for example, by L. Okay, if chi is the charge per unit length, and then L is the length, okay, along the wire, then the charge is given by chi times L. And the surface, let's enclose that with a closed surface, a pipe, like this. I draw that in a different colour. Okay, so here's our surface. The electric field points radially, okay? So because the electric field is circularly symmetric, it's always at 90 degrees with respect to this surface. And so this surface area of the surface multiplied by the electric field is going to be chi times L. And what is the area of this surface? Well, this is L, and the radius here is R. So the surface area is 2 pi RL. Oh, sorry, and that should be chi L on epsilon naught. So we end up with the formula that E equals chi over 2 pi epsilon naught R. Okay, so Gauss's law allows us to calculate the electric. Can you see that? Yeah. Gauss's law allows you to calculate the electric field given the charge per unit length. Simple, simple relation. Again, it's also going to apply to wires where the diameter of the wire is small in comparison to the radius of curvature. and you're close enough into the wall, yes?
So if you actually had a buffer in the electricity area on the outside, you'd have an ER after the area zero?
Yes, because you'd have an epsilon R as well. If this were in an infinite dielectric, you would have an epsilon R there as well, yes. So the electric field's reduced by that, and it's easy to see why, because these positive charges are going to pull electrons toward them in the dielectric, and that'll shield out the charge as seen at a large distance. So the electric field should be lower, and that's when epsilon R is greater than 1, which is what it has to be for dielectrics. All right, okay, so let's go here. All right, yeah. I'm going on into transmission lines now, so we'll have a look at transformers first.
Right.
Yes.
Like for the previous slide, you said for the Faraday's law, if you have a loop and there's a magnetic field surrounding that loop, you'll get an electric field along that loop for Faraday's law.
Yes.
How do you get the same analogy for Ampere's law?
Oh, well, it is the same. It's the same picture exactly, yes. You're worried about these two pictures. Well, here's Faraday's law, right? Electric field, and you've got a magnetic field coming out of the surface of the ball. Yeah. So be careful when you do that in a big magnetic field linking your loop, right? It's going to cause a heart attack. It's going to give you electric shock. Okay? That's the idea. Magnetic, bunch of magnetic field lines, you grab onto them, you've got an electric field and therefore a current flowing around in your arms, right? Same deal with Ampere's law, except the physics is different now. Here you've got a magnetic field going around in the loop, and you're grabbing onto currents. So these are current-carrying wires rather than magnetic field lines. They're magnetic field lines here, current-carrying wires here, or currents, really. Flowing charges is what they are. They don't have to be with wires. But now it's safe all of a sudden because the magnetic field's not going to hurt you. But it's still the same mathematics. Is that answering your question? Another way you can think about it is imagine that the current is actually current density. So then this becomes more like Faraday's law because we've got the integral of J dot dA to get the current. Okay? Got that? All right. Right here. Right, so we'll leave Maxwell's equations now and just look at something that's more particularly to do with wave motion, really. And we had an early lecture on transformers, which I have to say that apart from where you use these for impedance matching, is pretty useless. Okay, Nick did an auto transformer. He's the only person in the course who's done a practical implementation of a real transformer, and you can see that it's a four-port device, and the relationship between the output and the input currents is simply given by those parameters, the inductances. The L's are the self-inductances, and the M's are the mutual inductance. Reciprocity forces M to be the same regardless of which transformer winding you're looking into. In other words, the mutual coupling from one to the other is the same from the other to the one. So that's as general as one could expect a relationship to be. And it's its generality that almost makes it useless because it doesn't. The more general something is, the less it tells you about what it is. Okay? And then we went on almost the next lecture to transmission lines. There are two different types of transmission line that we considered. There are actually three in the course. Coaxial transmission lines, twin wire lines, and the twin wire line is a special case of strip line, which you can... is useful because you can etch it on a circuit board. And we use strip line as our... Here's a strip line here, as our way of deriving the equations of motion, wave motion along a transmission line. And so a transmission line... In this course, the ultimate thing that we ended up with was that transmission lines and transformers are the same thing at the end of the day, right? Transformers... You can treat them quite generally as we did on the previous view graph, but as I said, it doesn't tell you very much about how they behave. Yes, then.
How good of a dielectric is PCB?
How good is it? Yeah. Depends on which one you buy.
That's insanely high, so you don't have to care.
Sorry?
Well, if you bought one that had an insanely high dielectric constant, you wouldn't have to care about the
No, it can't. They can never have insanely high dielectric constants. I think it's about 7 or 5 or 7 is the most I've ever heard of, and that's not very high. Okay, it's 5 or 7 is not going to change the wave characteristics. Well, the bigger the dielectric constant is, the slower is the phase speed, and so the more accentuated are transmission line effects. Okay, we'll just revise that in a minute, actually. Lossiness is the other thing, and the circuit boards that you most commonly use are FR4 fiberglass, and it's very lossy, and if you want to work at high frequencies at all, then you need like 900 megahertz, you need Teflon. Equivalent to, and they have much lower dielectric constants, 2.2, typically. But with transmission lines, you always have to take into account the dielectric constant. The dielectric constant, the flexible dielectric used in coaxial cable, is polyphene, which is also not a very good dielectric. You can get Teflon that's flexible as well. It's just a Teflon that costs about $1,000 a kilogram. So you want to be careful how you splash it around, right? Okay? All right, so what we did with the strip line has this two-dimensional symmetry where we have the structure, well, all transmission lines have a structure which electric and magnetic field lines, the electric field lines in green and the magnetic field in blue, which are only varying in the cross-section. They don't vary along the line apart from wavelength effects. So when we look along the line, the electric field lines look straight. They look, they're not varying, but they do vary their sinusoidally because of the wave propagation effect. And so what we were able to do was to apply Faraday's law and Ampere's law in the absence of current, that is, displacement current, to derive two simple formulae relating the electric and the magnetic fields. Okay, and we showed that we could also relate these to the potential difference and the current on the line by simple geometrical parameters for a slab transmission line. And so we end up at the end. We showed that we could we had wave propagation. And there are two different types of waves that can propagate, one along the line and one in the opposite direction, but that's all. And so transmission lines are very simple compared as waveguides go, because most other types of waveguide have many different modes that can propagate. It's a pain, and trying to excite one and not the other requires a lot of effort. But with ordinary transmission lines, these two wire lines, you always have simply two modes that propagate with a plus or the minus wave vector. And we showed that the omega over k, which is the phase speed, which can be either plus or minus v, is given by this quantity here, where epsilon r is the relative dielectric constant of the dielectric material. And it's always greater than 1. So because this quantity here, square root of 1 over mu naught epsilon naught, where mu naught is the permeability of free space, and epsilon naught the permittivity of free space, this quantity is always less than the speed of light, okay? So it's always less than 3 by 10 to the 8 metres a second. In coaxial cable like RG58 with polyphene, it's about 2 by 10 to the 8 metres a second. V over I gives you a new parameter. This, you can see, is a property only of the line, and that is the characteristic impedance, okay? And so we had a few definitions here. For a wave that travels in one direction along the line, the voltage and the current are proportional to each other and they're in phase for a lossless line. Okay, and we call that ratio the characteristic impedance. And the planar transmission line, the strip line, that was how we introduced it. And for the ideal strip line where W is much larger than D, we have this simple formula. You couldn't get a simpler formula than that for the characteristic impedance. And in a couple of lectures ago, I derived the characteristic impedance of coaxial cable. And that had the advantage that it looked more complicated, but at least it was exact. This formula is a terrible approximation. And for most practical strip lines, you need a more complicated formula. But still quite analytic and workable. It's a tractable formula. Right. And so I also introduced the telegraphist equations. They result directly from those equations that we just had there. And this is the usual form of the telegraphist equations here, where L is given by Z naught over V is the inductance per unit length, and C1 over Z naught V is the capacitance per unit length. And you can rearrange then to find the phase velocity along the line and the characteristic impedance in terms of L over C. And for coaxial cable, we derived and we had these formulae in the last lecture. Okay. All right. There are a few things about transmission lines now that you need to, just due to the fact that we have wave motion involved now. When you do engineering problems in relation to transmission lines, you never need to know about really the wave motion per se. There are a few parameters that characterise or formulae that describe wave motion along transmission line that transform impedance and power values, and they're all you need. And the most important one is the reflection coefficient, which you've been introduced to in the labs now because the spectrum analyzer gives you reflection coefficients. It's a complex number. And the reflection coefficient is simply, if you have a wave propagating in one direction along a line, and then at the end of the line, you have a mismatch. In other words, you have you cut the line short, it's the simplest way, so it's no longer infinitely long, or you terminate it in impedance other than the characteristic impedance, then you get a wave reflected back. And the amount, you can calculate how much comes back by the reflection coefficient. And to derive the reflection coefficient, you know that the voltage across any load on the line must be the sum of the forward and the reflected voltage at that point and the sum of the forward and reflected current. However, because of the symmetry of wave motion, if the voltage is positive on the line and the current, then the current points in the direction of propagation of the wave, because the product of voltage and current must give you a positive power in the direction where the wave is going in order for the wave to be transporting energy. And that means that if you reverse the direction of the wave and the wave is propagating in the other direction, then when the voltage is positive, the current must now be pointing the other way. So that leads to a minus sign in the relationship between the forward voltage and the forward current compared to the reflected voltage and the reflected current. Right? The physics hasn't changed, only the direction along which they travel on the line. And combining those three equations, we end up with a simple formula for how much wave is reflected. And all it is obtained by taking the ratio of the reflected voltage to the forward voltage. And we get rho, ZL minus Z naught on ZL plus Z naught. When ZL equals Z naught, then there is no reflected voltage. And the wave thinks that the line is infinitely long. And the physics is simple. The wave propagates along the line, transporting energy given by VI in the direction of propagation until it hits the load, then it hits up the resistor and never comes back. So the energy is actually transported to the terminating resistor, characteristic impedance. All right, Owen, a wave terminated in a pure reactance can never dissipate power, so it must always have mod rho equal to 1. And you can let ZL be J by anything. The magnitude of rho is always 1. All right, then there are a couple of more complex formulae that I don't expect you to remember and will definitely be on your cheat sheet. The first one is that if you have a line of length L terminated in ZL, what impedance do you see at the beginning of the line? Okay, up here, and there's a formula for it up there. And it has a couple of special cases. If ZL is Z naught, then you can see Zn is Z naught, as it should be. Okay. If ZL is 0, then Zn is J naught, JZ naught tan beta L. And if ZL is infinity, it's Z naught on J tan KL. But notice that if KL is, in this formula, KL is equal to pi over 2, then there's another special formula, which I haven't written it down here, for a line that's a quarter wavelength long. That's when KL is equal to pi over 2, then Zn is equal to JZ naught squared over Z. Sorry, Zn is equal to Z naught squared over ZL when tan KL is infinity. And so transmission lines have the property that they can invert a terminating impedance. So if you have a 50 ohm transmission line terminated in a 1 ohm resistor and the line is a quarter wavelength long, then what's the input resistance? See?
You've got a line that's a quarter wavelength long, so 10 kl is infinite, and it's 50 ohm line, and you terminate it in 1 ohm. What's the input resistance?
10 kl is infinite.
Yes. So that formula becomes Z0
squared
on ZL.
Yeah, it's no. Z0 over ZL, so it's...
No. It's not Z0 over ZL. There's a miss. You've got another Z0 there.
Yeah,
right.
Z0 is squared over ZL.
Yes,
yeah.
That's right. Which is?
50 squared over 100.
2,500 ohms, yes. It becomes a way of transforming. If you have an impedance of 100 ohms, right, and then it becomes 50 times 50 over 100, or 25 ohms at the airport. And not what you normally do is you'll have a strip line for the transmission line, and you design it so that its characteristic impedance is equal to the square root of Zn of times Zl. You see that?
That's an interesting result.
Right, so if you
have
Zn equals Z naught squared on ZL, which occurs when KL is pi over 2, of course, then Z naught is chosen equal to Zn ZL,
then you have an impedance matching transformer.
An impedance matching line, just at one frequency. You see that? What you do is that, well, I've got Zn and I've got ZL, right?
But if I can choose Z naught equal to the square root of Zn ZL, and make the line a quarter wavelength long, then I've got myself an impedance matcher.
Okay? See that? Sometimes you can get out of these things much more easily with transmission lines and transformers,
or even worse, those horrible LC pi circuits and stuff, right? Very easy one-line derivation. All right, another formula that you sometimes find useful is that you can relate the voltage and current at any point along the line to the voltage and current elsewhere along the line if all you know is the length of the distance between them. So if you've got two points on a transmission line a distance L apart, then V end and I end means toward the load, and V in and I end means toward the generator. They're related to each other, which is sort of what you'd expect. You've got two waves that provide independent that are independent of each other, except for the terminating impedance, okay? But the characteristic impedance is all you need to know. And you've got a relationship that forces V end and I end to be related to V end and I end. All right, so this is the last thing in this lecture now. That was to point out that transmission lines always have a current going one way and a current coming back somewhere nearby. In a coaxial cable, the current flows, say, that way in the semiconductor, but on the inside of the other conductor, that exact same current must flow backwards, or otherwise you'd end up with electromagnetic fields inside this braid, inside the outer conductor. So transmission lines and transformers share this property in common. If you have a transformer which is wound so that these two turns are together at one end of the coil, and providing the assumption here is that the impedance of this coil is much larger than any of the impedances connected across the terminals of the transformer, then the sum of these two currents is zero. These currents are actually equal and opposite. And that applies also in the case of multi-layer transformers. So we have some rules for these so-called transmission line transformers. These are transformers that work at low frequency, but because of the way they're built, start to behave like transmission lines at high frequency, and so they have super high bandwidth. Okay? And the way you make them is you always wind them in multi-filer fashion. In other words, you always take the strands of wire and make sure they're twisted together to form a transmission line, so that there are current paths forward as well as backward. Okay, in that case, at very, very high frequency, where the ferrite no longer plays a role in the circuit, it now behaves like a real transmission line surrounded by air. Okay, there are lots of ferrites that one can use. Toroidal ferrites are my favourite ones because they're the most efficient. The other thing you must remember is that the dot on the transformer diagram points to one end of the wires at one end of the transformer.
The voltage drop across all windings must be the same. Why is that? It's Faraday's law of work, isn't it? If you've got two wires in the same point in space in a closed circuit, and you integrate around the closed circuit, and those two wires are in the same location, then they have the same magnetic flux linking them, and therefore the voltage drop across them must be the same. Got that? Okay. So they're the two rules of transformers, of transmission line transformers. The sum of all the currents must be zero, and the voltage drop across the windings is the same. Okay? Right, there is an issue with transformers. You have to be a bit careful how you use them. There are some things that you would never do to transmission lines if you want them to behave properly. And one example of that with coaxial cable is this kind of business. Suppose you've got a circuit like this. There's a coaxial cable. You come around to here, connect that to there, connect that to... Connect the ground to there, connect that guy up to there, like that, okay? You're going to end up with trouble with that circuit because you can never terminate it in its characteristic impedance. You've got the output current fed right into the input of the line. Those phase delays are always going to cost you frequency response, okay? And the same law applies to transmission line transformers. If you take a transformer, providing you feed it at one end and you take the output load across the output, then you're all right. You don't have to worry about the phase delay. But we did separate into two different types of transmission line transformers. Those which, despite everything, did not satisfy the delay criterion, and there are many more types of those. We call those Ruthroff-type transformers after the person who discovered them. But those that do respect the phase delay were called Guanella transformers. And there are a couple of examples. I can go through those heaps of examples, and I won't talk about skin depth, but there are heaps of examples of transmission lines that I'll discuss that in the beginning of the next lecture.